Welcome to this week's episode of The Read Out Loud, a weekly biotech podcast from STAT. I'm Allison DeAngelis.
I'm Adam Feuerstein.
And I'm Damian Garde.
It's Thursday, March 28th, and here's what we're going to talk about this week.
The Supreme Court is considering a case that could have dramatic effects on access to medication abortion and the development of new medicines. STAT Washington correspondent Sarah Overmall joins us to explain.
We'll also discuss the latest news in the life sciences, including a contrarian take on a new obesity treatment, a congressional effort to ban Chinese biotech companies, and how we managed to make 300 episodes of this podcast.
All that after a word from our sponsor.
Hey, Read Out Loud listeners, Bob Herman here, STAT's Business of Healthcare reporter and the writer behind the newsletter Healthcare Inc. Healthcare Inc. is a weekly newsletter devoted to unpacking the business and secret inner workings of the U.S. healthcare industry. If you're someone who has ever received a medical bill or craves in-depth policy explainers or loves a playful meme now and again, I highly recommend you check this newsletter out. Learn more at the link in this episode's description. And now, back to our regularly scheduled programming. Thanks.
So let's not bury the lead here. This is our 300th episode of The Read Out Loud. Congratulations, Allison, Damian, Teresa. That is a lot. That's a lot of podcasting.
You know, I don't think we look a day over episode 200. We've stopped aging.
It is good that this is audio.
Speak for yourself, so Allison.
There's no, you can't be confronted with the vision of your younger self. I suppose I could listen back, but I don't think my voice, although maybe I would be horrified to find out, but I don't think my voice has aged in a way to where it would be depressing to revisit an old episode.
I would love if a reader chimed in and was like, no, actually, Damian, your voice has aged greatly.
Yeah, so it's amazing. So we started this podcast. I look back, and it takes a while. Like, if you're in the Apple podcast app and you want to scroll all the way back to the beginning of, it takes a while. That's a lot of thumb scrolling to get to episode one. March 8th, 2018 was the first episode. Damian, you were on it. I was on it. Our former colleague, Rebecca Robbins, was our third co-host at that time. And do you guys know what we talked about on the first episode?
No.
You've mentioned okay, one name before the jump.
I looked. So the topics were, here we go. How long is Martin Shkreli going to be in prison? I think I'm pronouncing his last name right. I never can get that right. Is the biotech bubble about to burst? And then the third topic, what's it like to attend a blood swapping gala?
I'm sorry, what?
Wow. Damien, do you remember that story? The blood swapping gala story?
Yeah, Rebecca went, I believe it was in the great state of Florida.
She did, yes.
A sort of like seemingly unregulated or perhaps slightly outside the confines of the law clinical trial in which I believe it was, you know, younger blood being infused into older people, in many ways a harbinger, all three things, a harbinger of so much to come in American culture that we really had our finger
usually,
on the pulse.
And usually when you have one of those the headlines where it's a question, the answer is usually no, but is the biotech bubble about to burst? Yeah, it did.
It took like 4 years.
Well, you know,
that's true.
So,
we failed to, while we were prescient on the subject of young blood, apparently, we were not so much prescient on the subject of COVID-19, which, it being 2018, I think we can be forgiven for not seeing coming.
Yeah, right. Oh, exactly.
That's our bad. But speaking of COVID, episode 100, I want to read the little descriptor. After talking about hashtag coronavirus and clinical trials, we revisit the first episode to update the big stories of yesteryear. Wow, that was February 2020, I believed, when we were all still referring to it
February
as the novel coronavirus.
That started it all. And then we did like 3 years of COVID podcast. Helen Brandwell became our star. I mean, how many times did we have Helen Brandwell on the podcast to talk about COVID? We love Helen Brandwell, by the way.
We do. We adore her.
Yeah, Damien, what was the 200th episode of this podcast? Just, you know, because people care about these things.
Obviously, and so too do I so deeply that I have no recollection whatsoever of it taking place. However, I can see the teaser here, which is, can biotech companies age gracefully? where did COVID-19 come from? Which we had Antonio Regalado of MIT Tech Review, who at that point was launching a podcast on exactly that subject. And does Theranos make for good television? And these rhetorical questions, well, we learned, I mean, I guess it depends on one's personal taste, of the Theranos TV show that I think was about to debut on Hulu at that time. I thought it was pretty good. It won a lot of awards. Can biotech companies age gracefully? I mean, that's sort of a perennial question. I think we were talking about Biogen at that point. But we were definitely looking back on, you know, right, the former
horseman. Yeah, so horseman. March, that was March 2022. We were talking on episode number 200.
I would say that the Amanda Seyfried Theranos Hulu miniseries was such good television that it actually made Jennifer Lawrence, two-time Oscar winner, decide that she was not going to play Elizabeth Holmes in a movie. So I think we did answer that. It can make for good television.
That's right.
And that whole question of where COVID came from, well, oof, you can open up a big whopping can of worms with that one these days.
On episode 400, little do we know. We'll devote some time to that, yeah.
On episode 700, maybe we'll know.
Maybe we'll have an answer.
But we should say, in all seriousness, 300 episodes, that's a lot of episodes of this podcast, 6 years worth of the Read Out Loud. And obviously, we wouldn't be doing 300 episodes if it wasn't for people like you out there listening to this podcast. So thank you so much for wherever you listen to that, in the gym, in the car, on your way to work, picking up the kids at soccer practice, however you listen to the podcast, we very much appreciate it.
We really do. I want to turn it over. We started off with reminiscing about the old. We have something new this week, which is Adam's dedicated newsletter. And you had a rather contrarian stance on the obesity front this morning in your inaugural.
Can I do a shameless plug? Shameless plug
do
for
a shameless
the newsletter?
Plug. Do it.
Yes, I have a new weekly email newsletter. It's called Adam's Biotech Scorecard. The first edition of that newsletter dropped into inboxes this morning, Thursday morning. And it's a free weekly newsletter for Stat Plus subscribers. So please sign up. It's great. I hope it's going to be great. One of the items in the newsletter, just talking kind of a contrarian take on Viking Therapeutics. Most folks know, maybe have heard of them. They have sort of been the sort of darling of the obesity world these days, outside of obviously Lilly and Novo, which are the juggernauts, and everyone knows about those companies. But, you know, there's lots of companies who are sort of coming up behind trying to develop new, different obesity treatments. And, you know, Viking has been one of these companies that has sort of just the growth in the stock has just been just incredible, about 800% increase in the stock over the last year. It's a $9 billion plus company these days. And, you know, they have a GLP/GIP. I'm going to GLP/GIP. It's a GLP/GIP targeted. I like that. Targeted obesity treatment. So very similar to tirzepatide from Eli Lilly. They have their own. They've got a subcutaneous formulation. They've got an oral formulation. You know, so people are naturally speculating about, you know, which of the other big pharma companies out there that do not have obesity drugs in their pipeline today, who might acquire Viking Therapeutics. That is a hot topic in biotech these days. Because I love contrarians, I did reach out to a few people who sort of threw some cold water on this idea that Viking will be acquired, generally, kind of the argument sort of goes like this. Very simplistically, the argument goes that, you know, they while Viking's drug looks very promising, but it also maybe looks too similar to what Lilly is already doing. And at this point, they are so far behind that maybe sort of a me too approach will not be worth the, you know, $12 billion, $15 billion, who knows, $20 billion it could cost to acquire, not only acquire Viking, but then the billions of dollars more that you would need to run large studies and build up manufacturing for that drug. So, you know, the argument is that maybe they just, you know, maybe they're past their prime already, and that, you know, the approaches, there are other sort of other approaches, other targets in obesity may be more attractive to pharma companies who are trying to catch up.
I think that you can, for the obesity market, kind of give Viking a couple of plus marks for potentially the use of a pill form rather than an injectable, which is how most of the drugs that are on the market, you know, are manufactured and are delivered to patients. A pill form would certainly give you ease of access. Also, in the early data, now granted, this is very limited time spans, but it seems like Viking's approach has not seen quite the same side effects of nausea that, you know, the current slate of incretin inhibitors have. So I think you can give them kind of like check marks in those boxes for the pro stance. But given that so many of their kind of cohort of startups in the weight loss space have actually already been acquired by pharma, we've had, you know, Carmo Therapeutics, which was acquired by Roche. We've had Versanis, which was acquired. We've had at least, I think, two other acquisitions of startups. I think there is credence to your argument that the ship might have sailed on Viking, pun intended.
One thing I would say, Adam, about your newsletter, which of course I echo your recommendation that people sign up for it, but I think we mentioned on this podcast that it was developed under the working title Biotech AF, which of course is a pun on your initials and any other things that people might read into those two letters together. That is not what it's called. It's called Biotech Scorecard. But even then, I just noticed this morning, that abbreviates, of course, to BS, which is to say that profanity seems to just follow you no matter what you do.
You know, it's funny. We didn't go with Biotech AF for, you know, I guess obvious reasons. And actually, I got to say the editorial side of Stat loved Biotech AF, and that was what we were going to go with. But then, you know, those curmudgeons on the business side who think that maybe they'll be able to sort of sell this newsletter to sponsors. And hey, if there's a sponsor out there, sure, buy it. But you know, they're like, yeah, maybe AF is a little bit too out there for the business case. And so they didn't like it. But then you're right, Damien. So it's basically Adam's BS.
That's
what
right.
it is. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, and so the folks out there who hate me will say, yeah, you know what? Very true to form. Adam's BS.
What a good cell phone, Adam. You've already called out your own BS.
Yeah, exactly. And at the end of the newsletter, there's a photo of my dog, Bo. So that's also amazing. Very nice. Moving on to other things. Damien, tell us a little bit about Wuxi, this Chinese CDMO manufacturer of drugs, and why everyone is worried about their existence these days.
It has become very interesting. So Wuxi AppTec and Wuxi Biologics, two separate firms. It's a complicated history. The point is basically they make their money by contracting with drug makers around the world to do research, manufacturing, the development of medicines, basically anything that a company might want to outsource. And this is a common practice long throughout the drug industry. We don't really talk about it in forums like this because, I don't know, we don't generally talk about the suppliers of the Pfizers of the world. Rather, we talk about the Pfizers of the world. But they exist, and they exist in a very lucrative space. And Wuxi has been really one of the major growth stories in that industry over the last decade by virtue of providing cost arbitrage, which is something businesses are looking for. They're based in China. They tend to have a lower price point, or at least they did in rising up, but they also established a mark of quality. Wuxi is a trusted partner to drug makers around the world. And that's just kind of how it's been. And we don't talk about it because that's boring. However, that has since changed. In Congress in the United States, there is a bill moving through both the House and Senate called the BioSecure Act. And what it is described as doing is protecting, I guess, intellectual property, but really more so human data on Americans from Chinese firms who, according to the sponsors of this bill, have ties to that country's government that make it a national security issue that they not know about your genome, for example. So, you know, one can debate the merits of that as a thing. For a long time, the bill listed companies that do genomics, that handle genomic data, and thus could conceivably be party to this potential national security issue. However, in recent months, Wuxi has been added to that list. And if this bill were to pass, all of the Chinese companies listed on it would effectively be banned from doing business in the United States. It would ban companies that do business with them from doing business with the government. And because Medicare, Medicaid, the VA are major customers of drug companies, it would effectively ban them from doing business with companies like Wuxi. So this gets us into a really kind of fascinating thing because, one, Wuxi has said, we don't have ties to the government. We don't, you know, we're not harvesting your data and selling it for nefarious purposes and threatening national security. We're just doing what we've always done. And the interesting thing is that about 65%, about two-thirds of Wuxi's revenue comes from American pharmaceutical and biotech firms. So this is an existential risk for Wuxi. It would cut their business by two-thirds, basically, if they were banned from doing business in the United States. But it's also a serious risk for those companies that contract with them, which include Eli Lilly and other large drug makers, in that if they were forced to suddenly have to reshuffle their supply chains in terms of research, development, and manufacturing, I mean, it would cause huge disruptions, it would be very expensive, and it would just introduce risk, which is something that major drug companies are very averse to. They're in a very risky business. They don't want to take risks when it comes to who you pay to sell you, you know, the active pharmaceutical ingredient in whatever your product might be. So this is all just kind of, it seems to have come out of nowhere. A lot of people seem a little befuddled as to how Wuxi got on that list. Among those people is Senator Rand Paul, who kind of spoke against the potential of this bill in a Senate hearing on it. And yet, it continues to move forward. It passed a Senate subcommittee. It may come up for a vote. There may be an effort to attach this notion to a broader defense spending bill. That's one of those things that people try to attach bills to because it kind of has to pass for the sake of American politics. And we're in this fascinating situation where I'm not sure how this is going to shake out or what conversations are taking place behind the scenes, because you have to imagine, as I mentioned, major and influential American drug companies could conceivably see this as a threat to their businesses.
So, Damien, well, yeah, is this Damien related at all to the... I'm sorry. All right, go ahead, Nelson. Go.
Okay. Quickly. Well, yeah, Damien, to your point, there's still so much that's unfolding about this situation that, I mean, I agree, from my perspective, seems to have popped out of nowhere. I mean, I do go back and think to the CFIUS regulations that, you know, popped up in 2018, 2019, which almost seemed kind of like a first step of, you know, kind of introducing some sort of firewall between China and U.S. businesses. But in terms of this and how they landed on Wuxi, I'm not really sure. I think it's worth noting that President Biden had signed an executive order that was very similar to this legislation, but did not name specific companies, which it seems some in the bio industry prefer. Also, what happens from here on out feels like it's going to move very rapidly. Just this morning, Reuters reported that U.S. lawmakers were told that Wuxi actually did share client intellectual property with Chinese authorities. And then also in recent days and hours, one of the sponsors of this legislation announced that he would not be running for re-election, that he will be leaving Congress. So who knows what's going to happen by our episode next week with regards to Wuxi and this regulation.
So Damien, let me ask you a question. It seems like at various times the biopharm industry has gone through these kind of existential bottleneck crises, you know, where something happens that you know, everyone kind of gets really worried about that threatens the entire underpinnings of the industry. But we always seem to, or they always seem to kind of work around it, or it doesn't, it, you know, the worst fears are not realized. Will that happen here? I mean, let's say Wuxi can't, you know, the worst things happen to them. And I mean, are there other companies out there in other places, you know, here in America or other countries that can sort of pick up the slack?
Yeah, I mean, it is hard to imagine elected officials at the federal level doing something that would completely undermine the American pharmaceutical industry, which has a very powerful lobby, which has presences in various jurisdictions, and which, you know, just in fairness, is a pillar of the American economy. So a few potential things as to how this cat that is the drug industry will inevitably land on its feet. One, there could be grandfather clauses if this bill were to go forward, such that if you do business with Wuxi today, you don't have to find a new contractor a week from now. There would be some kind of gradual push into it. And then likewise, as you mentioned, this is conceivably a huge business opportunity for the contractors based in the United States who would be delighted to take on the business that companies are currently doing with Wuxi. And there's a whole again, not something we really talk about on this podcast much, but there's a whole thriving industry of CROs, contract research organizations, contract manufacturers, and et cetera, operating in the United States. Who could take that up? There's also the potential for, not unlike what we're seeing with the congressional discussion around TikTok, where I've heard it floated that the company that owns that social media platform called ByteDance could conceivably split itself apart and, you know, have an American American unit that would be, you know, operated independently of the one based in China. There could be a Wuxi America, much like there are two Mercs, one in America, one in Germany, that dates back to the First World War, where a similar thing happened with America's relationship to Germany. So I do think the likeliest outcome is that pharma is fine, because that tends to be the likeliest outcome of any of these conversations. But it is interesting, zooming out, that, you know, Allison, as you mentioned, this current sort of trade war with China dates back to the Trump administration, the CFIUS stuff, where a few acquisitions were blocked and there were escalating tariffs and et cetera. It has now persisted into the Biden administration, which, you know, is represented by the other political party that is powerful in this country, suggesting that this isn't a momentary snap of policy, but rather a long-running and apparently escalating issue between the United States and China. And that's something that the drug industry is going to have to comport itself with. It wasn't that long ago that in a much more dovish environment between the two countries, the drug industry was investing heavily, which it still is, in China to develop molecules that it might eventually market in the United States. And we were in this sort of moment of globalized science, and everybody was saying nice things to each other and taking pictures together. That seems to have kind of passed. And we've seen something we have talked about on this podcast was the demolition, basically, of a company called EQRX, whose whole founding ethos was that it would source medicines developed in China and sell them at a lower price in the United States because they would be cheaper to develop by virtue of where they came from. The FDA, depends on whom you ask, I think it's fair to say, changed its mind about how that process might work regulatorily, and it destroyed EQRX's whole value proposition. And now we're kind of living in a post-EQRX world, and this feels like a facet of that.
We don't talk about the Supreme Court very often on this podcast, but on Tuesday, justices heard oral arguments in a closely followed abortion medication case that biotech and pharma companies warn could upend the industry and paralyze new drug development.
Joining us now to discuss Tuesday's hearing and its broader implications is our colleague and DC correspondent, Sarah Overmull. Sarah, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So, Sarah, most of our listeners are probably aware of the basic background of this case, but can you remind us how we got to this point and why mifepristone has garnered so much argument between court justices, FDA figures, and others?
Right. So the FDA approved mifepristone in 2000 for abortions up to 7 weeks of pregnancy, and they extended that to 10 weeks in 2016, citing data about its safety up to 10 weeks. And then in 2021, under the Biden administration, they removed the requirement for in-person prescribing, which sort of opened the channels for it to be prescribed over telehealth and sent through the mail, which became really important to people seeking abortions after the fall of Roe and with bans across a wide number of states this point. But a Christian-based medical organization brought a lawsuit in Texas, in a sort of notoriously conservative district of Texas, to argue that increased access to mifepristone violated their conscious objections to abortion, and that if they were forced to treat people who had taken this, it would be violating their beliefs. And so this was started in Texas, where the judge there actually struck down the entire approval. That was reversed in an appeals court, but that court did uphold the reversals of these 2016 and 2021 changes that allowed more access. And so then it ended up at the Supreme Court.
So beyond the ramifications for reproductive rights, which are fairly obvious here, tell us about the impact that this case potentially could have on the biopharma industry.
biopharma executives, the major lobbies for this industry, pharma and bio, have now argued that if the Supreme Court upholds a lower court's decision, essentially stepping in on the FDA's regulatory decisions, then that destabilizes the whole regulatory process because anyone could theoretically sue about a politicized or controversial medicine. And, you know, all those millions of dollars that that biopharmaceutical company put into that medication or product are now jeopardized. Now they have to defend that product in court, which is expensive. And so, you know, the examples that have been thrown out are the COVID-19 vaccines or hormone therapies and other forms of gender-affirming care or birth control, that this just sort of makes any medicine vulnerable to political attacks.
So as we mentioned at the top of the segment, the news this week was justices hearing oral arguments in this case. You were there for that hearing. What happened and what can we, I realize I'm asking you to speculate, but what can we glean from what's taken place this week as to how the court might finally rule on this?
Well, what was interesting about the hearing is that almost every justice who spoke, Brett Kavanaugh did not, interestingly, almost every justice who spoke was asking about whether the physicians who brought this suit had the right to do so in the first place, rather than talking about whether FDA had the right to, you know, relax some of these restrictions about around mifepristone. And so while you, as you said, you can't, you know, speculate too much on how the justices are thinking, the sort of the amount of questions that had to do with standing on this case indicate that they are worried that the plaintiffs just don't have the case. And so a lot of them were asking about, well, what is a scenario in which one of these physicians would actually have their beliefs violated and would not have a chance to object? And they didn't seem so convinced by the plaintiff's lawyer, Aaron Hawley, who is drawing out the scenario in which someone who consciously objects to abortion is forced in an emergency room setting to treat someone with complications from a mifepristone medication abortion. And there simply is not another healthcare worker around who can do that. And so that person has to assist in that treatment and potentially expose themselves to liabilities around that treatment.
So the court is obviously split ideologically today. And it seems that the questions the justices ask can often reflect this divide. Was that evident at the hearing on Tuesday?
It was, but not necessarily to the extent that you might have thought of, considering how political this is. Much of the justices, including several of the conservative justices, were stuck on this question of standing and stuck on the question of how much risk is actually associated with, you know, prescribing mifepristone over telehealth appointments or extending it up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. Of course, Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas seem to be more sympathetic to the plaintiffs than the others, but they also were asking questions about standing. And they were asking, well, if these people can't bring this case, then who could bring a case to challenge the FDA on a regulatory decision?
So legal scholars that you spoke with after the hearing suggested, you know, as we mentioned already, that there's a strong chance that the court dismisses the case. Maybe kind of explain further sort of why they believe that.
Well, it's the standing issue again, and just the fact that, you know, there are very, very narrow circumstances where someone would have standing on an FDA decision about a drug's approval or a drug's restriction. Because in order to have that standing, sorry to say that 10 times, the word standing, but, you know, you have to prove that the FDA decision to approve a product or restrict a product actually harmed you and that it could harm you again. And so it has to be more direct. The Biden administration is arguing it has to be more direct than what these plaintiffs are fleshing out. You know, I talked to a few scholars who said maybe it would be a situation where, you know, a drug was so dangerous that emergency rooms were flooded and the hospitals and healthcare workers simply could not keep up. That might be an issue, but that hasn't really happened with mifepristone.
So, Sarah, you had a story just this morning following the hearing looking at, you know, somewhat addressing Alito's question of who can sue the FDA. It has happened before. What's the history?
Yeah, so I was really interested in that because, as we talked about, Alito and Thomas kept asking that question. And there have been plenty of times in history where people have sued the FDA for more access to a drug or for access to an experimental therapy that hasn't been approved yet. But I was really interested in whether the opposite, the mifepristone example, has happened. And the answer is it has happened before with opioids, but there wasn't much success there either. And so I spoke to someone named Ed Thompson, who actually used to work at Johnson & Johnson way back in the 70s. And he was telling me about, you know, being there for some of their first opioid approvals. He started to take issue with the fact that these were being prescribed for long-term use and for chronic pain, even though he argues there is no evidence for that and it's actually actively harming people. So he also tried to sue on the same argument that this decision by FDA was actively harming him and other people in the industry and would harm them again because people were dying from the opioid crisis or becoming addicted to these medications. That was also thrown out on standing. Once again, it's very, very difficult to establish that. So once he realized he probably was never going to be able to establish that, you know, this FDA decision around opioids was harming him, he decided to manufacture his own version of oxycodone and basically apply for FDA approval on that pill, but say explicitly in his application that it would not be approved for long-term use and chronic pain because there was no evidence of that. And his argument here was that if the FDA approved his versions of that pill, then identical versions on the market would have to essentially take that label on. The problem is that the FDA rejected his application and he took them to court again, and that was also thrown out. So other people who have contemplated, you know, suing on access to opioids and trying to pressure the FDA through the legal system to restrict access have seen cases like this and said, you know, it is just legally seemingly impossible to get this done. And so a lot of the people I spoke to have said really the best ways are citizens' petitions, public campaigns, and what people like Public Citizen, to be honest, have been doing for years. But the legal system is just not the place for this, is what they've said.
So we've obviously talked a lot about the plaintiffs, their standing, whether they have it or not, in this lawsuit. What about the FDA? You know, if the court decides to dismiss the mifepristone case, which it seems there are indicators that they might, what does this whole situation mean for the FDA going forward?
Well, if they decide to dismiss it, the FDA is probably going to be pretty relieved, but I don't think the danger is over for them yet. I spoke to a regulatory expert yesterday who actually didn't want their name attached to this thought because I don't think they wanted it put out in the universe. But they said, you know, say President Trump gets reelected, puts new people in at the FDA, at HHS, at OMB, Office of Management and Budget, which oversees a lot of FDA regulation. I realize I have DC brain. If he puts new people in there and they decide to actually re-reverse those mifepristone regulations and require in-person prescribing or even shorten the authorization to 7 weeks again, that if this court establishes that, you know, the people who brought the suit don't have standing, then presumably if advocates for mifepristone tried to bring a suit, it would be even harder for them to establish that they have an argument. Considering it more now, I do think that in a scenario where a Trump administration restricts mifepristone again, there would be potentially easier examples for abortion advocates to draw about people who were denied access to mifepristone, especially in states with bans. And then, you know, there could probably be some more clear examples of people who had serious medical events because they could not get access to an abortion. So, you know, for now, what a dismissal of this case would mean is immediate relief for the FDA and for the industry. But I think this is not going to go away necessarily.
Well, it sounds like this is a case that you'll be reporting on for a while now, Sarah, whichever way it goes. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
That does it for the 300th episode of the Read Out Loud.
Thank you to Teresa Gaffney for producing this week's episode.
Our senior producers are Hyacinth Empanado and Alyssa Ambrose. Our executive producer is Rick Burke. And our theme music is by Brian Joel.
We'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you like about this week's episode, what you didn't like, and make a prediction. What are we going to be talking about on the 400th episode of the Read Out Loud? You can do all that by sending us an email at readoutloud@statnews.com.
And if you like what we do, leave a review or a rating on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you use to get your podcasts.
See you next week.